Chapter 4 Paradise. To seek glory in battle is glorious, jumped in above Lemuria again. This time the little frigate emerged at a high enough altitude that it could immediately jump away if needed. The ship's crew was increasingly anxious. Each time they raided the planet, they were certain this time would be their last. The Kristang Task Force had lost one ship early in the raiding campaign. A frigate had been caught in a damping field by two Ruhar destroyers and blown apart in spectacular fashion. Some in the task force, including the Glory's captain, thought the now-dead ship had pushed its luck and been showing off, hoping to impress the task force commander. All that foolish ship had accomplished was to provide the hated Ruhar with a morale boost and place a greater burden on the remaining ships in the task force. The Glory's mission on this particular raid was to test how the Ruhar would react to an enemy ship burning crops of the humans. To test whether the Ruhar would react at all, if they cared in any way about human crop losses and the potential for widespread starvation. The last time the Glory had jumped in to target the southern continent, the frigate's mission had been hoping to lure Ruhar ships away from the northern continent again. The Ruhar had fallen for the trick the first time, and paid a price when a Kristang destroyer jumped in and struck several important sites on the northern continent. The second time, the Ruhar had been more cautious. From what little the Kristang had been able to decrypt from Ruhar messages, the Commodore of the Ruhar ships was under heavy pressure to defend the Ruhar population and facilities. How much damage would the Ruhar allow the Kristang to inflict on the humans before the Ruhar sent ships to chase the Kristang away? How many ships would the Ruhar Commodore send, and what tactics would he use? Bringing back answers to those questions was the true purpose of this raid. Any damage inflicted on the traitorous humans would be a bonus. It would serve the humans right if they starved to death. If they were truly honorable warriors, they should have fought the Ruhar to the last man. Instead, they laid down their weapons like cowards and meekly became farm laborers. To seek glory in battle is glorious, set its maser cannon on broad spectrum and began methodically burning out fields of human crops. Wherever the maser touched, crops withered and died, all moisture boiled away by the scorching beam. To the surprise of the frigate's captain, a full 7 minutes went by before the Ruhar Commodore sent a single frigate to deal with the intruder. The Glory had been maneuvering randomly to dodge unenthusiastic maser and railgun fire from the Ruhar before the defending frigate jumped in. To show the Ruhar that the warrior Kristang were not afraid in the least, the Glory stood its ground for 20 seconds, exchanging fire with the enemy frigate, then jumped away. Its mission had been entirely successful, and large swaths of the southern continent lay in waste. Precious human crops had been destroyed, and valuable intelligence about the tactics and capabilities of the Ruhar had been gathered. That night, the Glory's crew would feast deservedly. Earth. My father drove me down to Bangor right after we finished dinner. On the way down, we talked a lot, but not about the future. He understood that I didn't know when or if I would be leaving again, or when or if I'd be coming home. It was rough on my parents, but then I thought of all the parents whose children were trapped on Paradise. At least my parents had been able to see me twice, even if only briefly. Going back to Dayton meant I might be able to see Rachel again. I was looking forward to that. As soon as I got into my hotel room near the Bangor airport that night, my Z-phone pinged. It was Skippy. "Hi, Joe. I couldn't talk to you while you were with your parents. There's something you need to hear. You don't like me telling you about things I overheard, but you seriously need to make an exception in this case, because it's about you." "Wait, give me a hint first, then I'll decide whether to listen." Crap. I'd been hoping for 6 hours of sleep before I had to get up. "UNEF Command has been holding what can best be described as hearings, almost a court-martial, about you." "That's not a surprise. They're not happy with me. I know that." "It's more than that, Joe. This is political. They've decided to send the Dutchman back out, duh, and there are a lot of people on Earth who want to command the mission. They're looking to stab you in the back to get you out of their way." Again, no surprise there. "What you don't know is they brought Major Smythe into Wright-Patt yesterday, and he..." "Major Smythe?" "Yes, he was officially promoted. Will you shut up so I can finish the story? Here, watch your Z-phone. I recorded what Smythe said. UNEF doesn't know I recorded it, so don't say anything, please." I lay on the bed, propped myself up with pillows, and watched my Z-phone. It was as interesting as Skippy promised. It was a typically bland government conference room, There was a table on an elevated platform at one end of the room. Six generals from multiple countries and services were sitting behind the table. On the floor were other ranks of tables, and I immediately recognized Major Smythe. He looked unhappy. The quality of the video was not great. This might have been Skippy doing his surveillance through dust particles trick. One of the generals was speaking. I didn't recognize him, but from his uniform he was U.S. Air Force. Major Smythe, quoting from your report, you described Colonel or Sergeant Bishop this way. Bishop can present himself as inexperienced, immature, inattentive to duty, and generally unsuited to command. I notice in your report you did not refer to him as Colonel. Yes, the general cut Smythe off before he could finish. Could you explain why, despite your description of Sergeant Bishop in your report, you recommend him to command humanity's only starship again? Smythe took a sip from his water glass to collect his thoughts.
Because, sir, if Colonel Bishop told me we were going to crash the gates of hell and the only thing we had for weapons were plastic spoons, I would follow him without hesitation. So would every other member of the Spec Ops teams from the last mission. I would follow him because I know that he would have cooked up some daft plan that any sane person would say is high and off to the right. Smythe used a U.S. military term. Yet somehow his plan would work. Sir, I've seen Colonel Bishop dream up things that would make your head spin. But it works. It works. He comes up with ideas that even the AI hasn't thought of, things the AI didn't even realize it could do, such as how we killed that Theranin surveyor ship. Colonel Bishop had the idea for Skippy to create an especially flat area of spacetime that would attract the business end of an enemy jump wormhole. It worked perfectly, sir. Perfectly. And Skippy didn't even realize he could do that until Colonel Bishop explained it to him. Also, sir. Smythe had gotten up ahead of steam and plowed ahead before he could be interrupted, leaning forward on the table for emphasis. Colonel Bishop is absolutely dedicated to duty. On that space dive he did, he offered to sacrifice himself to ensure success of the mission. Even after those two tankers jumped away and our dropship was able to recover him when his spacesuit was leaking air, he ordered the dropship to recover Skippy first.
Sergeant Bishop's admirable personal courage is not in question, nor is it relevant to this discussion. We are focused on his judgment. The generals on the dais nodded, unconvinced. Thank you, Major. We will take your remarks under advisement.
Permission to speak freely, sir? Smythe asked.
The generals glanced at each other again. Getting your frank and honest opinion is why we brought you here, Major.
Thank you, sir. In my report, I stated that Colonel Bishop can present himself in a particular manner. I didn't say he actually is like the negative things I described. At first, I did think Bishop was immature and almost flippant, I think is the best word, about the situation. Since then, I have come to realize that is simply his personality. I have seen Colonel Bishop be deadly serious when the situation calls for it.
He coughed, took a sip of water, and continued.
In my opinion, sirs, we would be foolish not to continue with the most experienced commander we have, the only experienced commander we have.
Experienced, although he took an extreme and unwarranted risk by landing on Newark. He landed in direct contradiction to a standing mission objective.
Smythe was unfazed.
No, sir, he did not. He ordered the landing as the only certain way to support the mission objective.
Colonel Bishop took action to preserve the Flying Dutchman's combat capability as long as possible. Faced with unknown future risks, he preserved our ability to take effective future action. If he had not done so...
It was Smythe's turn to look around the room.
There would be a Theranin ship on its way here now, and there would be absolutely nothing we could do about it. The mission objective was to prevent aliens from learning that humans have a starship, and that we were involved in shutting down a wormhole. We were able to accomplish that objective only because we landed on Newark. Orders issued on Earth cannot anticipate every situation we may encounter during an interstellar mission. We need a proven commander we can trust. Bishop is our only experienced commander.
My Z-phone screen went blank.
Skippy, I asked, where's the rest of it?
Oh, the rest is blah, 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 more of the same. What I wanted you to see is that Major Smythe has your back. He's a good guy, in my opinion. The other Spec Ops team leaders all supported you.
So did Lieutenant Colonel Chang, Major Sims, Captain Desai, Sergeant Adams, everybody.
Wow, they brought everyone there?
Huh? No, UNEF Command is holding reviews in all 5 UNEF countries. Only Major Smythe flew into Wrightpad. Get some sleep, Joe. I think you are going to have a tough day tomorrow.
Right. Like I was able to sleep after that.
Paradise. To seek glory in battle as Glorious emerged over Lemuria in a sudden state of gamma radiation, repeating its previous mission of burning human crops while keeping the Ruhar defenders off guard. This time, it took only 4 minutes before the Ruhar dispatched a single frigate to chase the glory away, and the 2 frigates tangled for another full minute before the Kristang ship jumped away. The little frigate Glory had accomplished its mission once again. The Ruhar defenders could not get any rest because of the constant threat of raids. Even more important, their ships were deferring important maintenance, which would soon begin to affect their combat readiness. The Kristang were gaining important intelligence about the tactics of the Ruhar. And the traitorous humans were being hurt. 16 humans had died during the raid, and their food supply was now dwindling rather than increasing. Earth. What I encountered when I got to Wright-Patterson was not a court-martial. Not exactly a hearing, and not quite an inquisition either. Whatever they were calling the meeting, I was facing a row of senior officers from the 5 countries making up UNEF, and they didn't look friendly. The official subject of the meeting was to make preparations for the Flying Dutchman's next mission. The unspoken subject of the meeting was my competence and fitness to command a vital off-world mission, or my lack of competence and fitness in the view of UNEF command, which became clear from the tone of the questions. Of the 5 generals grilling me, the Chinese and British were mostly neutral, while the other 3 acted like I shouldn't be trusted to command a rowboat. The most hostile was U.S. Army General Ridge, who seemed to think my perceived failings as a commander reflected badly upon him personally. For almost an hour, we danced around the question of who would be in command when the Dutchman departed. Then there was a commotion in the back of the room. I tried to ignore it, until the row of senior officers in front of me halted the questioning.
"What is it, Major?"
General Ridge asked. A U.S. Air Force major in the back of the room answered.
"General, we appear to have lost all contact with the Flying Dutchman. We have tried contacting people directly. So far, no..."
"Wait, I'm getting another message." The major, whose name I didn't know, held the phone close to his ear. His face turned white.
"General, the starship has disappeared. We've lost the Dutchman."
Ridge turned to the Frenchman to his right, General Blanchard.
"Louis, this had better not be one of your tricks,"
Ridge said in an unfriendly tone. The skeleton crew aboard the Dutchman was nominally under French command that week.
"I know nothing about this, Thomas," Blanchard protested. "We lost the ship. It jumped away."
"No, sir," the unnamed major reported. His shaky voice echoed the tone of panic in the room. "There was no gamma ray burst detected. It simply vanished."
"Sirs," I spoke up hesitantly. All eyes in the room turned to me. I swallowed hard and said,
"That sounds like the Dutchman engaged a stealth field. That type of field warps electromagnetic radiation, such as light, around the ship. That would make the ship appear to have disappeared."
Ridge glared at me.
"Sergeant, why would the ship engage stealth in orbit? Did the ship detect a threat?"
"In case of a threat, the ship should have immediately jumped away to assess the situation. That is my standing order." I coughed nervously, suddenly all too aware that my ability to give orders to the Dutchman's crew was over. That standing order had been my reaction to watching too many dumbass commanders in science fiction movies who waited until their ship had been pounded half to dust before they tried to get away. I was not taking any stupid chances with the Dutchman. If the duty pilot thought there was something squirrely, they would have jumped away without asking for permission.
"Sir, if I can contact Skippy, I can confirm."
"Do it, Sergeant," Ridge ordered. "You have your Z-phone?"
"Yes, sir, but I think that is not necessary. Skippy, are you there?" His voice came out of the projector system speakers.
"Ho there, Joe. Yep, I'm here in my comfy escape pod man cave as usual. Right now I'm channel surfing, enjoying a bowl of popcorn and cold brewskis. How are you doing down there?"
I had no doubt that Skippy was indeed currently surfing the content of every TV channel, radio station, and website on the planet. But he also knew exactly what was going on with me.
"Hey, Skippy. We've lost contact with the ship.
Did you engage the stealth field?
Darn. You saw that, huh?
And more like we noticed there suddenly was nothing to see. What's up with that? Out of the corner of my eye, I saw two of the UNEF staff shaking their heads at my unprofessional, casual language. Screw them. They didn't know Skippy like I did. They hadn't worked with Skippy to save the world. Save the freaking world twice.
I'm not feeling the love, Joe. So I metaphorically have pulled up the rope ladder to my treehouse fort, and I'm not allowing anyone up here unless they know the secret handshake. I don't have hands. Maybe it should be the secret password. Yeah, that's it.
Mr. Skippy, General Ridge said, automatically looking at the speaker like I did, although it made no difference.
You were threatening to lock us out of our ship?
General Fudge.
Skippy made me wince when he said that. Two things. First, it is not your ship. You haven't spilled any blood or risked your life up here or survived for weeks on crappy Theranin sludges. So until you wear the Paramecium with eye patch badge on your uniform, you will never again refer to the Flying Dutchman as your anything. He didn't wait for an answer. Second, a threat is a statement of intention to perform a hostile act in the future. I have already done it, so the threat phase of this incident is over.
My eyes opened about as wide as they could go as General Ridge shot me an angry glare.
Skippy, General Ridge is...
Yeah, he's served with honor, blah, blah, blah. None of that means squat to me, Joe. Where was he when I was stuck on a dusty warehouse shelf? Where was he when we captured two warships? I don't remember him space diving with me and offering to risk burning up in a planet's atmosphere so I could complete the mission. Enough with words. Only the cool kids can come aboard the Dutchman. Fudgy is not one of the cool kids.
Ridge didn't get to be a general officer by being intimidated by words of any kind.
What I have been told is that you, Mr. Skippy, can't maneuver any ship you are aboard. We have the capability to reach Earth orbit on our own, and our people up there should be capable of disabling the stealth field eventually. We can regain control of that ship.
Sure. You flying monkeys can come up here. If I were you, I would be very careful to make damned sure this ship's defensive weapons are not on automatic. It would be terrible if one of your crappy space capsules got shredded by a maser cannon.
Skippy, I said through clenched teeth,
that is not funny.
I wasn't joking, Joe. The crew up here could try to deactivate those weapons, but since you can't communicate with them, there's no way to be sure they were successful before you launched from orbit. And I know the crew here will do their best, but darn, these Theranin controls are complicated. Best not to let monkeys screw with the controls. I'll lock them out to be safe. There, that's done.
General Ridge looked like he was about to bust a blood vessel. I spoke quickly before he could say anything that Skippy might object to.
General, I warned. Too often we think of Skippy as a lovably mischievous beer can. He is not. He is an ancient artificial intelligence who was created by a species that built the wormhole network. Sir, I have seen Skippy rip a hole in a star. He is not joking when he says that he will defend himself. We cannot screw with him.
Well said, Colonel Joe, Skippy chuckled.
Now, General Fudge, you consider yourself to be a plain-spoken man, so let's cut through the bullshit right now. You need the Flying Dutchman to go back out in order to verify there isn't another Theranin ship on its way to Earth. The Dutchman can't fly without me, and I'm not helping the merry band of pirates fly the ship unless I'm happy. So here is my very simple condition. Joe Bishop is captain of the ship. He is astonishingly stupid most of the time, but he has flashes of competence. Oh, one more condition, I guess. The French team brought a horribly stinky cheese up here with them last time. Ugh, I still got maintenance bots scrubbing the air filters near the galley. So, no more stinky cheeses. That's it, I think. Now, Fudgy, you can continue talking if you want, but you're wasting everyone's time. And in this case, time is not money, it is lives. The lives of every human on Earth, who are at risk every day the Dutchman is not out there safeguarding your miserable planet.
Damn, I thought. That was a good speech. Of course I didn't say that. What I said was, Skippy, we all heard you loud and clear. You've made your point. And could you please take the Dutchman out of stealth, restore communications, and take the defensive weapons offline?
For you, Joe?
Certainly.
Done.
In the end, Skippy got everything he asked for.
Unfortunately, despite all of his amazing intelligence, he neglected to ask for the right freaking thing. UNEF grudgingly confirmed me as the captain of the Flying Dutchman and restored my theater rank of colonel again. That is what Skippy demanded. I was not, however, going to be commander of the mission. UNEF insisted on assigning me a senior UN official from a neutral nation as overall commander. He was Austrian, and his name was Hans Chotek. Naturally, that is not what Skippy called him.
Oh man, I screwed up big time, Skippy lamented.
I'm sorry, Joe. What's this guy look like? I had a briefing packet on Hans Chotek, but I hadn't read it yet.
Well, Joe, he looks like a movie star.
Skippy's praise surprised me. That was a nice thing to say, Skip. If the movie star had gotten run over by the ugly truck and died several years ago...
Whew! Are we really going to be stuck with Count Chocula for the whole mission?
Count Chocula? That made me laugh. How did you get that name?
Count, because his family traces back to royalty in Austria, and Chotek sounds kind of like chocolate. Also, one of his ancestors made his fortune in chocolate, so...
Oh, man. You didn't tell him that you named him after an American children's breakfast cereal, did you?
First time I talked with him, yes, of course I did. Come on, Joe. You know me. No way could I pass up a golden opportunity like that. He had no idea what I meant at first, so I changed his official UN photo online to the Count. I'm sure he will get a good laugh at it someday. He hasn't been laughing so far.
That means he did not find it amusing. Skippy, do you really think it is best to antagonize the guy right from the start? If we get off on the wrong foot, Joe...
I want to get off on the wrong foot with this pompous jerk. I want him to know crystal clear right off the bat that I do not want him on our ship at all, Skippy said, mixing metaphors liberally.
Our ship? Me, you, the merry band of pirates? I'll include Dr. Friedlander, too, because he tells good jokes and it's fun to mess with him.
Not that you would do something like that to our rocket scientist.
Not as far as Friedlander knows, Joe.
Great. So we have a captain and a commander, and we'll get a crew. There was one thing that I need from you, Skippy.
What is that? He asked warily.
I promise that this time, we will be bringing the Dutchman back to Earth before you go do your beaming up to the collective thing.
Oh, that's easy. The answer is yes. Yes, we will. Joe, we can keep looking for comm nodes, because I need to know whether the two we have found are defective, or, I hate to say this,
well, the comm nodes work fine, but there is no longer a network for them to connect with. But I do not want to contact the collective until we have answers for the strange and disturbing things that have been going on in this galaxy.
Because you're afraid of looking ignorant in front of the collective? I guessed.
Because I'm afraid of what I don't know, Joe. More importantly, because I'm afraid that a lot of what I think I know doesn't match facts we have recently discovered. I can't trust my own data, and that scares me.
Paradise. General Nivelle, the current commander of UNEF on Paradise, addressed Deputy Administrator Logelia in her office.
We are prisoners of war, and you are our captors. You have a responsibility to protect us from harm during our captivity, Nivelle declared.
The leadership post had recently rotated to the French after the Chinese, and Nivelle almost wished the rotation had skipped over him. It was a thankless and largely powerless position, from which the soldiers of UNEF expected him to produce miracles on a daily basis. The raids on human cropland by the Kristang were becoming a serious problem. Not only were humans dying directly by being caught in the path of a maser beam, but the expected crop yield had now been reduced by 7%. The next harvest was now anticipated to be just above the level required to supply humans with daily calories. There was no longer a safety margin for crop failures. Rain and hailstorms wiping out fields, transport disruptions, or anything else that surely would happen along the way. Most troubling was that the Kristang raids seemed to be growing worse, and the Ruhar were not doing anything about the raids. During the last two raids, the Kristang ship had been free to target human croplands for several minutes without the Ruhar taking any action. Humans were dying by maser fire, and soon would be dying of malnutrition and starvation.
Legally, no. We do not. Responded the Burgermeister carefully. The combatants in this war do not have the equivalent of your Geneva Convention, she pronounced slowly so the translator software could catch up.
Nivelle had expected that response and was prepared for it. He noted that Ms. Logelia had pronounced Geneva precisely, which told him she had practiced for this conversation. Good. Better for him to have this discussion with an alien who was at least informed about Earth customs.
I have studied the history of this seemingly endless conflict you are engaged in. You are correct that there is no formal signed treaty between your government and that of the Kristang. There is, however, an unspoken agreement that has been adhered to by both sides for hundreds of years. You treat Kristang prisoners as you would wish the Kristang would treat your people if they were captured, and the Kristang generally have done the same. Prisoners are provided food, shelter, medical care, regular opportunities to exercise, and are allowed limited communication with their families. You also regularly negotiate prisoner exchanges. There is in effect a de facto Geneva Convention agreement, whether it has been formally signed or not. We humans have not been provided food and shelter. We grow our own food and build our own shelters. Medical care is limited to what we can do with the extremely limited supplies we have left. And we have had no communication with Earth since you took this planet back.
Lavelle glanced out the window behind the Burgermeister where a gunship fighter aircraft that humans called a chicken was taking off. A real window, in a real office, in a real building. Lavelle's ad hoc UNF HQ office in Lemuria was a partition in a tent, and he slept in a tent. The Ruhar had offered equipment, supplies, and even a few workers to help construct a building. Lavelle and the UNF commanders before him insisted the effort would be better directed to more important facilities for humans, such as hospitals, air raid shelters, barracks for housing, barns for livestock, and storing harvested food. Luxuries like offices could wait. One thing Lavelle had noticed as soon as he was invited into the Burgermeister's office was the smell, or lack of it. His own tent had a pervasive, musty scent of dampness and mildew, despite the high-tech anti-mold chemicals provided by the Ruhar. The problem with the cluster of tents that served as UNEF's temporary headquarters was that in the jungles of Lemuria, it rained every single afternoon. Sometimes it rained more than once a day. Humans were not the only creatures struggling to adapt to the jungle. Many Earth crops did not grow optimally in the hot, humid conditions. Ruhar scientists were working, when they had time and resources, to tweak the Earth's plants' genetics to grow better and yield more in the jungle. Nothing had been promised to UNEF about using the supremely advanced biological knowledge of the Ruhar other than that they were doing what they could. Doing what they could for free, for an enemy that had tried to eject them from their home planet. The southern portion of Lemuria was generally drier grasslands and would likely be better suited to human habitation and Earth crops. Moving farther to the south was not an option, the Ruhar had declared. It was too far away from the support facilities of the northern continent. And because of high mountains that cut across Lemuria east to west at the southern end of the jungle, there were no roads to the southern grasslands. Humans needed to deal with the situation as best they could. They didn't have a choice.
The situation, the Burgermeister said quietly, is complicated by the fact that you are being attacked by your own side, General Nivelle. When you came here to occupy our planet, the Kristang were your patrons, and you were their client species. You were acting at the orders of the Kristang, and with the support of the Kristang to remove my people from their home, this planet. That arrangement, that relationship between humans and Kristang, has not, to my knowledge, changed. Even under a de facto Geneva Convention, as you said.
The translator stumbled over de facto, but Nivelle understood.
We are not responsible for internal enemy affairs. Likewise, you do understand that if we did negotiate a prisoner exchange, we would not be responsible for the fate of you humans once you are back under Kristang control.
We have not asked to be exchanged, Nivelle said stiffly.
I would not recommend it, the Burgermeister said with grave seriousness. We have monitored the transmissions the Kristang directed at you. They consider you to be traitors. The Kristang deal harshly with those who they feel have betrayed them, even among their own kind. With species they consider to be inferior?
She shook her head.
If you were turned over to them, they might execute all of you. Certainly they would execute you personally, and the top echelon of your command, and probably any female humans in a position of authority. You know now the Kristang philosophy on proper gender roles. the female deputy administrator of the planet said with a grimace. So when a Kristang ship raids this planet and kills humans, we must view the incident at least partially as a matter internal to the Kristang Coalition.
We have no option then, Nivelle said bitterly. We can't switch sides and join the Ruhar. Our governments back on Earth have declared loyalty to the Kristang.
That is not true, the Burgermeister announced, shocking Nivelle. There are many cases where one group of a species splits from its parent and switches sides.
I am surprised to hear this, Nivelle stuttered. How is this possible?
It happens over the course of a very long war, the Burgermeister said with a human-like shrug. For example, there is a group of Kristang who live on a planet that my people captured around 400 of your years ago. These Kristang decided to stay and repudiate their allegiance to the two clans they belong to.
This can't be a common occurrence, General Nivelle asked warily.
It was a special circumstance, she admitted. The Kristang on that planet had been isolated from the rest of their kind for many years. The planet was at the extreme end of the territory the Theranan controlled. Then the Jirapha cut off the Theranan's access to a wormhole, and the planet became isolated. We ignored the planet for over 2 centuries, merely monitoring it to assure the Kristang there did not pose a threat to us. By the time we besieged the planet, the Kristang there had drifted far from the cultural norm of their species. They declared that the Kristang had lost their souls to the Theranan, that their true culture had been perverted by their patrons. These Kristang, who now call themselves the True Ones, are not entirely consumed by warfare, and they requested our assistance to return their females to their original genetic baseline. These True Ones could be considered neutrals, or as close to neutral as any sentient being is allowed to be in this galaxy, she observed sadly. Their industry provides material support to our war effort, and they have been provided warriors to fight alongside Ruhar. The warriors of the True Ones are known for being absolutely fanatical in battle. They know that if any of them are captured by the Kristang, they will be tortured and killed.
I am asking a hypothetical question. You understand what a hypothetical question is?
Nivelle was not entirely confident in the translator. Eventually, he needed to learn more than a few words of Ruhar. The Burgermeister nodded silently, so the UNEF commander continued.
If we humans here on Paradise were to offer allegiance with the Ruhar, would it be accepted? And what would that mean for my people, here and on Earth?
Materna Logelia paused to collect her thoughts. She could not tell the human commander that her own government was negotiating to trade away the planet, in the process screwing both the native Ruhar and the humans.
The decision to accept your allegiance would be far above my head. I could make a discreet inquiry. However, it would take several months at the very least. My confidence in our communications security is not sufficient for me to trust sending such a message via electronic means, no matter the level of encryption. Such a delicate matter would require me sending a courier to our home world.
Seeing Nivelle's crestfallen look, she hastened to add,
We have couriers traveling regularly. The next is scheduled to depart within 2 weeks.
A discreet inquiry would be greatly appreciated, Madame Logelia. This is, of course, all hypothetical.
Of course, she smiled. General, you should not discuss this with anyone, unless you are standing in a field, far from any electronic equipment. I do not think I am giving away any secret when I say that your own communications are entirely compromised, since your Z-phones, she used the human slang term, use our satellite network. If the Kristang are able to intercept our satellite communications.
Understood, Nivelle said helplessly.
There was no point in attempting to establish a separate human communications network. The Ruhar could easily breach even the best human encryption. Nivelle suspected the Ruhar had the capability to implant nanoscale spies directly into the hardware, so they wouldn't even need to bother with decrypting signals.
There was no point to complaining about something he could do nothing about. Earth. It was great to have settled the question of whether I would be in command of the next mission, or even going at all. It was not great that UNEF Command wanted the ship to depart Earth orbit within 17 days, and we had a tremendous amount of work to do before then. Major Sims, who had volunteered to go back out, needed to replenish our supplies. Skippy had to oversee manufacture of some key ship components that he hadn't been able to make from moon dust on our last mission. He was given a blank check to use whatever manufacturing capability he needed on Earth. Well, that was less useful than I expected, because Skippy told me human materials technology was so primitive, it was in many cases easier for him to create needed things from raw materials. Major Sims was in charge of coordinating with UNEF Command all the items we would need for the next mission, and the large list of equipment Skippy said he needed to continue repairing and upgrading the Dutchman. Sims and I went over the list at Wrightpat, and some of the things Skippy wanted puzzled us both. "Skippy," I asked, "this is a big list. I can see how most of it would be useful, I guess, but why do you need 6 crates of WD-40? WD-40? Oh, that was just me messing with you. You monkeys didn't know that was a joke? Damn, your species is clueless sometimes." Sims looked like she would have tossed him out an airlock right then if we'd been aboard the Dutchman. I wasn't happy with him either. "That was not funny, Skippy. We've got people working 24/7 down there to..." "Yeah, yeah, blah, blah, blah. I get it, Joe. Won't happen again. Man, you hate it any time I have fun. Listen, to be serious, there is only so much I can do to keep the ship running without access to a Theranin space dock. Star carriers are designed to operate on their own for extended missions, but we've been out on our own for too long, and the ship got beat up pretty badly on our last mission. Eventually, we will need access to Theranin spare parts, or we're going to need another ship." "Crap." I looked at Sims, and we both frowned. "Not on this mission, right?" "That depends on how long the next mission lasts and what kind of stress we put the ship through, Joe. I can't make promises without knowing the parameters. On the last mission, we didn't expect to get ambushed by a Theranin destroyer squadron." He had a point. I didn't like it. Until then, the thought that the Flying Dutchman would wear out, could wear out, hadn't occurred to me. The technology of the ship seemed more like magic than anything created by living beings. Skippy did a great job behind the scenes, using robots to perform maintenance, and even daily chores like cleaning and doing our laundry. Whatever Skippy did to keep the ship operating was invisible to me. It was time I started paying careful attention to how much effort went into keeping the ship's magical machines working. The other thing that was not great was that UNEF Command put me on a plane flying to Paris that very afternoon. Paris, France, not the one in Texas. I went into a bathroom on the plane for privacy and called Rachel on my Z-phone.
"Hi, Joe," she sounded happy. "How is Maine? I checked the weather report this morning. It looks nice up there."
I'm on a plane to Paris," I blurted out. "Paris? I've always wanted to go there."
"This for work?"
There was a tone to a voice that I interpreted as asking whether I was going to Paris with a girlfriend. "Yes, UNEF sent me. This is a last-minute thing."
"Are you coming back to Dayton?"
"I don't know. Rachel, I truly don't know. The ship is going back out soon, and I didn't know what else to say."
"I see."
Her voice changed, and I couldn't tell whether she was hurt or angry or relieved.
"You don't know when you're coming back?"
"No. Damn it. I had always sucked at talking over a phone." "Rachel, we don't even know where we're going." I took a deep breath. "Listen, Rachel. When I get back..."
"Joe," she interrupted me. "Were you about to make a promise that you don't know if you can keep? Don't do that."
I what? I'm an idiot?"
"You're lonely, Joe. I could tell that right away. You were away from home for a long time, and now you're going back out. We had fun. I'm glad I met you. It's not like you left in the middle of the night. You have a mission, and you have to go. I understand. I was in the Air Force, remember?"
We awkwardly chatted for another few minutes, ending with me saying that if I could get back to Wrightpat before going into orbit, I would contact her. She told me that wouldn't be a good idea. I could see her point. When you tear off a Band-Aid, you don't want to put it back on and do it again. Best to get it over with once.
My history with women seems to be they had me on a catch-and-release program. If my past was any indicator, Rachel had her fill of Joe Bishop and was ready to move on. Crap, my longest current relationship was with a shiny beer can. Maybe I needed to seriously rethink my life.